which we measure our pain.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now in the studio is Vincent Bugliosi, author of the new book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. He was the prosecutor who convicted Charles Manson in the Tate-LaBianca murders. He is a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders, The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose Our President, and The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vincent Bugliosi.
Always happy to be on your show, Ian.
And last time we spoke, of course, you brought forth a case against George W. Bush for murder. This is a case that you've brought forth here about God. And the extent to which, I guess it's not a plague on all religions so much as a kind of an even-handed attack on both faith and atheism.
I'm very democratic. Attack atheism. To me, atheism is an intellectually empty philosophy whose current provocateurs, I'm talking about Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and Richard Dawkins, simply cannot find a non sequitur that they do not like. I do spend most of my time, of course, with theism, pointing out that the pillars of theism, I'm talking about things like the virgin birth, free will, the immortality of the soul, they do not withstand scrutiny. I have to say that I'm more excited about this book than any other book I've ever written. I'm not saying it's my magnum opus, but why am I excited about it? Well, number one, there's no more important subject than God, Ian, as you know. Whether you're against God or you believe in God or not, it's very important. Also, this is a 2,000-year-old conversation, and I don't have to tell you about the books that are on the bestseller list dealing with religion. The number one book in the country right now is a young boy at the age of 3 apparently had an appendectomy operation, and during the operation, he sees Jesus and John the Baptist, etc. The Da Vinci Code, you know, Jesus married Mary Magdalene and had children. This is very, very, very heavy here, and this is why I'm so excited about it. When you look at the pillars, what I discovered here, and I attacked it the same way I would any prosecution of a murder case. Look at the evidence and then draw powerful inferences from the evidence. If anyone is not startled by what I come up with in this book, they're the type, Ian, that would not be surprised if they saw an alligator doing the polka. If we have time, I'd like to talk about some of the findings. Do we have time?
Well, let me, though, just focus in on one thing, which I think as a prosecutor, particularly having prosecuted important murder cases, you always, your case rests on evidence.
Yes.
The thing that I find extraordinary about religion is that the initiating epiphany for most religions, they are legends without evidence. And you have a whole chapter in here, Hey, Look at Us, We're Just as Silly as They Are, where you break down all of the theistic religions in comparison to Christianity, where you spend most of your time, ending up with the Mormons, and there's a perfect example.
Right.
The evidence mysteriously disappeared.
Right.
Always that is the case, it seems. Mm-hmm. So how did something get so entrenched in so many minds around the world, and yet there's absolutely no surviving evidence of the moment of birth?
Here's the interesting thing. Yeah, there's no evidence, except it's a very, very important point. It's almost the heart of my book right here. If you were to ask me, is there immortality of the soul? Is there a virgin birth? I'd say, well, you can ask your local grocer. I mean, how do I know? However, when Christianity takes the position that the reason they say these things is that there's evidence in the Bible, they claim there's evidence in the Bible, then I can go and say, wait a while, folks, either there's no evidence of the Bible, or in the Bible it says the exact opposite of what you say. So they think there is evidence to support some of these things. Free will. Contrary to popular belief, and Christians say, God gives all of us free will. It's in the Bible. I go to the Bible and find out that not only doesn't the Bible support the notion of free will, but it supports the exact opposite, that there is no free will. Does that mean there's no free will? I haven't the vaguest idea. But the Bible, and they claim there's evidence in the Bible for this, says no free will. It turns out that the immortality of the soul, I went way, way back, went to the roots like I would if I was prosecuting a case. It's an invention of Plato, who uses four foundationless presuppositions for the immortality of the soul that Judaism and then Christianity buy into. Why? I'll tell you why. They had to buy into it because without the immortality of the soul, there's no life after death. And if there's no life after death, there's no heaven and hell for Christianity, for instance, to offer or threaten the masses with. classic example, the virgin birth, Matthew in 1:22-23 specifically says this is a virgin birth because it's the fulfillment, they're talking about the evidence, they think, a fulfillment of a prophecy by Isaiah in 7:14. He was prophesying a virgin birth. We go to 7:14, and what do we find? Isaiah doesn't talk about a virgin birth. He says a young woman, not a virgin, a young woman is going to have a child. He uses the word Alma, which is Hebrew for young woman. The word for virgin is Betula, and the Bible uses the word betula when they're talking about a virgin. So there's no basis for it. There's no basis for the assertion that Isaiah was talking about a virgin birth. He was talking about a young woman having a child. And then we go further. What is Isaiah talking about in 7:14? Here's what he's talking about. It gets a little confusing. I'm going to try to simplify it. He's telling Ahaz, who is the king of Judah at the time, look, you don't have to worry about these enemies of yours, Syria and Israel. Israel at that time was northern Palestine. You don't have to worry about them because the sign that God has given you is that this young woman is going to have a child. And before the child learns the difference between right and wrong, your enemies are going to be dead. Now, who are the enemies? It was Pekah, the Israel king, and Rezin, who was the king of Syria, okay? Those two died, in fact, around 731 BC. So what are we talking about here now? What are we talking about? We're talking about the prophecy in Isaiah that Matthew says pointed towards the virgin birth of Jesus. The prophecy of Isaiah was fulfilled close to 800 years before Jesus was even born, totally negating the allegation of Matthew that Isaiah in 7:14 is talking about the virgin birth. Now, the importance of this cannot be overestimated because if you eliminate the virgin birth, that means that Jesus was not the son of God. He was a son of a mortal man and woman, presumably Joseph and Mary. And if you eliminate his being the son of God, Ian, what do we have? We have that the Christian doctrine that God had his son die on the cross for our sins, that goes out the window too, in effect, ravaging Christianity. And I'd love to hear what the Vatican has to say about this. I think they'd rather stare into the noonday sun than address themselves to this matter. And here's the central question. How do you keep, I know it's going to sound pretty far-fetched what I'm saying here, but how do you keep the doors open to the hundreds of thousands of Christian churches around the world if it turns out, and I support this in the book, if it turns out that Jesus was not the Son of God? These Christian churches, they're shrines to Jesus, not to the monstrous God of the Old Testament. The very name Christianity is 95% Jesus. And I'm telling you, put my reputation on this, the Bible, if you look at the New Testament in conjunction with the Hebrew Bible, proves not only beyond a reasonable doubt, Ian, but beyond all doubt that Jesus was not the Son of God. And I think I have a certain way of analyzing evidence. I think I have a certain credibility in that. Last month, at the invitation of the Pentagon, I gave a three-hour lecture to a conference of Marine prosecutors down at Pendleton. So I know how to analyze evidence, and I'm telling you, the Bible, which they claim has the evidence to support their position, absolutely supports the opposite, that Jesus was not the Son of God. Now, if that's not heavy, Ian, you tell me what's heavier than that in the world of theology.
Again, I'm speaking with Vincent Bugliosi, the author of a new book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. I don't know whether the insecurity that I detect in religion has anything to do with the case that you've just made. But we are living at a time where clearly we've noticed the entire federal budget was about to be shut down over religious ideology to do with abortion. And that strikes me as not indicating the power of religion providing strength and comfort, but the insecurity of religion where some men are afraid of women having too much freedom. And equally in the news, there was the burning of the Quran by an obscure pastor with about 10 followers down in Florida that suddenly became an international incident. In Pakistan and Afghanistan, people were murdered because the sacred text of the Quran was more important than the lives of human beings. Mm-hmm. Again, this indicates to me a terrible insecurity. Mm-hmm. So why is it that the religions seem to have at their core not the strength of spiritual liberation, but the insecurity of
doubt. You're asking me a question that's impossible to answer, except to tell you that maybe deep down, there's a little voice in their ear saying, you know, we're saying these things, we say we believe in them, but we really don't have any evidence and proof to support what we're saying, and that manifests itself in this insecurity that you're talking about. I want to say something because I think it's important. This book is not for people who are deeply religious. My daughter, Wendy, said, Dad, I don't want you to hurt anyone with this book. And she's already got two close friends of hers, deeply religious, who want to read the book. Please don't read this book. It's going to hurt you. The consensus of people who have read this book is that no one who reads it is ever again going to feel the same way about God and religion. And I don't want to hurt anyone. Now, someone might say, oh, come on. What he's trying to do is use reverse psychology, the forbidden fruit doctrine, to get people to read the book. If they're going to say that, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm telling you, I'm sincere when I would recommend that if someone is deeply religious, they have no question about God and Jesus, and they get a lot of comfort and strength and solace from their belief in God, I'm not kidding you, I would recommend that they do not read this book. This book is for Christians who believe in God, but have a lot of doubts. I talk to these people all the time. I believe in God, but I've got doubts. It's certainly a book for agnostics and atheists, but I'm absolutely troubled by the fact that someone deeply religious picks up this book. One of my, one of her close friends, her husband died at the age of 40, and she is absolutely convinced that her husband's waiting for her in heaven. And you pick up a book like this and you read what I say about heaven and hell and God and religion, she's going to be hurt. So this is not a book for someone who's deeply religious.
Again, I'm speaking with Vince Bugliosi, the author of Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. But you do make a distinction in your book, The Divinity of Doubt, The God Question, Vince Bugliosi, about that morality and religion aren't the same thing. And it seems to me that when you express these concerns, it's worth noting that as much as centuries of pain and bloodshed have been inflicted on humanity in the name of religion, on the other hand, there are examples how religious communities brought about positive change.
The
end of slavery, the end of the nuclear arms race, etc. So how do you take the good, the part that motivates people to do good works, and separate it from the other part that causes them to be xenophobic and hateful?
I can't separate the two. These are two existing realities, and I say candidly, I'm not a student of history. I don't know what the net would be. There's no question, as opposed to Christopher Hitchens, who finds nothing good about religion, there's no question that religion has helped people through the night, as it were. I mean, it's warmed candles of strength. It's softened the pangs of fear and all that throughout history. Tolstoy said it's the leading force in history, a belief in this supernatural being. So there's no question that it serves a purpose, it helps, but on the other side, we have to know, no question about it, that it's caused unbelievable horror and atrocities and murder and misery and suffering throughout the centuries, and it continues to this very day. Whether it's a positive or a negative, I don't know. Thomas Huxley, who gave the name agnosticism, in the 19th century, he said, if you put it on balance, he says, religion has helped, no question about it, Christianity has. But if you put the two on balance, there's no question that Christianity and religion have done more harm than they have good. But whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I don't say religion is bad. There's much good about religion. What I do say is that when you're talking about God and you have all these beliefs, where's your evidence, okay? Where's your evidence? This book is a book about evidence. I use the same technique that I use in handling any case. Look at the evidence objectively, and the evidence is my only master, and then draw powerful inferences from that evidence. And when you come up with evidence that the Bible says there's no free will, and you can't find any evidence in the Bible for the immortality of the soul, and you find that from the Bible, Jesus is not the Son of God, I think that's pretty heavy stuff, Ian. If you know of more heavy things that are out there, I'd like to know what it is.
Well, I think in a way, though, Vince Bugliosi, again, the author of Divinity of Doubt, The God Question, one of the problems here is that even if you take the religious person gently into that good night or that bad night for them, in the sense that you're pricking this bubble, it seems to me there's a defense mechanism built into religions that, particularly in Christianity, where any attack as you have just made, where's the evidence? Show me the beef. Show me the money. Show me what's going on here.
No, I have come up with the evidence in this book.
I know you have, but...
I have. I got a tremendous but you're challenging number the of biblical reader. Citations. In
right, but you're challenging the you know, saying, look, there is no evidence. You've said that. My question is, doesn't that lead immediately to play into the kind of martyrdom complex? That's the problem. The defense mechanism is automatically there. They become martyrs. It actually reinforces their belief system as opposed to...
Well, yeah, what you're talking about is the old phenomenon that if you tell people the truth, they start attacking you because they want to believe the truth. Socrates told someone, please don't get angry with me if I tell you the truth. There's an old Turkish proverb, whoever tells the truth is chased out of 9 villages. A Yugoslavian proverb says, tell the truth and run, okay? But the thing is, Ian... there is the Socratic imperative that the truth is more important than anything else. And even though this may create a lot of ruckus out here, and I'm certainly not happy about it when a deeply religious person is hurt by this book, I think the truth is better than the suppression of truth. Knowledge is better than the lack of knowledge. But I repeat, I'm not saying that I know whether these things exist. I'm saying that if Christianity says the Bible says something, then I can step in and say, hold it, folks, the Bible doesn't say that. It says the exact opposite of what you're saying. And that's a contribution. I think you'll agree with that.
Right. Do you think that you can make the case that if a believer, and particularly a Christian, since you deal mostly with Christianity, but you do equally analyze the foibles of all the other religions.
Yes.
If they were to read the book, accept the fact that there's no evidence, would that make them a better Christian?
Oh, boy, you got the reputation you have, which is a good one, because you know how to ask tough questions. I'm supposed to tell you whether they'd be better people, better Christians, if they didn't believe? I don't know the answer to that. I do not know the answer to that. I know that people fear. I have a chapter on death here that people just, you know, say, God, I don't even want to think about what he's saying here. People don't want to die, okay? And they don't want to think that once they die, it's the end of it for them. And you're saying that if you take all this stuff away, see, a lot of these people believe that they're going to go to heaven. And you're saying if you take that away from them, are they going to be happier? They're not going to be happier, I don't think. Are they going to be better humans? There's no way for me to know something like that.
Well, it's just in the last second, my argument essentially is that this is why I think we should teach comparative religion in school.
Yes.
Not have this separation between church and state that doesn't work and which has created all these religious schools.
Mm-hmm.
My argument is that if you have a broad menu
yes.
of religion, you're able to sort of look at it all, you end up with a kind of warm and fuzzy feeling about it all
yeah.
without being completely locked into some dead-end dogma.
Yeah. Well, let me just make an observation off the top of my head that what you're talking about is reaching things by way of intelligence, and intelligence is good. And I would agree with you. Socrates, the truth and everything. But if you look at a scale, it might look like this, that as you go up the scale of intelligence, you go down the scale of happiness, you know. You follow what I'm saying? That ignorance is bliss, okay? So... there's a real problem here. Let me leave one little footnote. There's no question, beyond all doubt, that the Bible says that Jesus was not born of a virgin. The only thing they have left is a resurrection. That could still exist. He's divine, not the Son of God, but he's godlike. And the strongest piece of evidence there is all these followers of his willing to preach his message throughout the Mediterranean world, including in Rome, knowing that they might get killed, and many of them died. Now, why would they be willing to die for something they knew was a lie? That's a very powerful argument for the resurrection. Now, let me take it down a notch. The whole importance of the resurrection, no one's ever risen from the dead. Jesus did, i.e., he must be divine. The problem is that Matthew, in I think 27, somewhere around 50, 53, says that when Jesus died on the cross, there was a tremendous shaking of the earth, an earthquake, etc. And the tombs opened in the Jerusalem cemetery, and holy people rose from the dead, walked out of the cemetery, went into Jerusalem, and were seen by a lot of people. That takes the specialness and the uniqueness of Jesus rising from the dead down a little bit, if we're to believe Matthew. You can't pick and choose and cherry pick, because Matthew's the one that said Jesus rose from the dead, and he's talking about all these other people rising from the dead. It's a fascinating study. I've been fascinated with God and the whole study for so long, but I finally decided to take it to another level, immerse myself like I do in everything, you know, for 2 years, 7 days a week, and see if I could determine whether universally accepted beliefs and centuries-old religious beliefs had any merit to them. And what I discovered, as I say, is so heavy that if someone's not startled by it, then they wouldn't be startled if they saw a man jumping away from his own shadow.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Vincent Bugliosi. Again, I've been speaking with Vincent Bugliosi, author of the new book, Divinity of Doubt, The God Question. He was the prosecutor who convicted Charles Manson in the Tate LaBianca murders. He is a New York Times bestselling author whose books include Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders, The Betrayal of America, How the Supreme Court Undermined the Constitution and Chose Our President, and The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder.
Thank you, Ian.
I would also like to invite you to a free public forum at the Hammer Museum this Tuesday night, April 26th at 7 p.m. We'll be discussing the new global financial elite with the financial journalist Felix Salmon again, April the 26th, this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m. Please come. And on a more somber note, I'd like to recognize Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. Please tune in to tomorrow at 5 p.m. With Background Briefing. We'll be talking with Richard Avassian, UCLA Professor of Armenian and Near Eastern History. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producers Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. You can hear this program at ianmasters.com. You can also check out my blog. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. Bye for now.